Come right in, pull up a chair. It's time once again to gather around the gaming table with your friends at The Gaming Gang. Proudly sponsored by Victory Point Games. This time around, Elliot will be reviewing Nature of the Beast from Eye Level Entertainment and Star Trek Fleet Captains. Jeff will be reviewing Nexus Ops from Fantasy Flight Games and the Mistborn Adventure Game from Crafty Games. We'll have news, views, and much more on this episode of The Gaming Gang. Now here's your hosts, Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller.
Hi, I'm Jeff McAleer.
And I am Elliot Miller. How you been, bud?
I'm fine.
What's been going on?
Of course, listeners out there, those visitors to the website know that I was at VolCon 2012 in Phoenix, Arizona last weekend.
Uh-huh.
So I did hang out there last weekend, did some interviews. We got a great interview with Alan Emmerich, our good pal from Victory Point Games, as well as Darren Johnson from Imperial Outpost Games, located in Glendale, Arizona. Todd Van Hooser, who's an author and also the author of the role-playing game Adventures Under the Laughing Moon, and the guys over at Crash Games. So there's a few cool interviews, a lot of fun. Also did our own little VolCon extra podcast last week, and that created a bit of a stink with some people here locally.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest, I don't care. It's really not my problem. My issue is not what I had to say. I call it like I see it. And if people don't like that, well, I hate to break it to them. That's just the way it goes. And I love how you commented. There was a variety of different comments about the little extra that we did.
Uh-huh.
And you basically said, hey, you know what? You don't like it? Go start your own game website.
Right.
Your own show. And don't bust our chops about it.
Right. I mean, either people like us and listen to us or they don't.
And that's fine. I have no issue with that. I voice an opinion. I'm not someone who tells you you have to listen to me. I'm just telling you what I think. And I'll tell you one thing. I certainly wouldn't lie about something.
No. Well, I mean, what would be the point, really?
No, there's no point. It's not as if our audience is here in Arizona. Our audience is everywhere.
Everywhere. Worldwide.
Everywhere. Worldwide.
Except in Europe.
It's our global network.
Welcome to the Global Gaming Gang Network.
I'm sure there are some countries in the world that you've made comments about that now they don't listen to us. But, you know, that was just you.
I don't know what you're talking about, man.
Yeah, I've thrown some jokes out there, too, that just probably didn't go off too well. So, yeah, of course, I did that. And outside of that, I'm just playing some games, trying to get some reviews done, and trying to keep the website up and humming like it normally does. What about you? What's going on with you, Mr. Miller?
Let's see.
Okay, enough. I don't care. Anyway, moving right along. I'm kidding. Yeah, what's going on with you?
I got my first recommendation of the podcast. May have made some last podcast. I don't know.
What do you mean by that? You got your first recommendation on the podcast.
I have my first recommendation for this podcast.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was like, what? Somebody sent you a recommendation about the podcast and it would be the first time you received something like that?
We recommended your podcast to Geriatrics Unlimited.
Those old folks, they love us.
Yeah, well, the war game stuff, you know.
Hey, stop it. I'm fighting against the graying of the hobby. Come
right.
On.
Well, it's because we're getting to that point.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah, I've been playing war games since 1974.
I started playing war games before there was even war.
The Big Bang Theory. My wife started me watching that show, and I have to say it is excellent.
Do you do everything your wife tells you to do?
Well, yes. Yes, I do.
That's how you stay married. That's the whole key. No wonder I'm single. Damn.
Well, we kind of get a competition going on, like, who can recommend a show that they think the other person will really like and then get into, and then you get to claim credit for recommending that show.
Okay.
It's kind of funny.
I mean, it is funny. I mean, it's cool, but I mean, that is kind of funny.
And then,
I mean, you're married. It's not as if you're recommending something to somebody who's across the country from you.
Right. Well, and then what happens is once there's a show that's established that we both like, then neither one of us can watch it when the other one isn't around.
Gotcha.
So I keep looking for shows that, okay, well, I can't watch this now because this is now one of our shows. So, for example, I started watching Once Upon a Time.
Which I have not watched that yet.
It's really a good show. It's got a goofy premise where there was a magic spell cast in medieval times or whatever when this evil queen put a whole town into a time loop, right? So now it's present day and they're all characters from various fairy tales.
Right. So it's just like the Fables comic book from Vertigo. Yes, I'm familiar with that. And one of the reasons I haven't watched it is because it did seem like it was kind of completely ripped off from the Fables comic.
Oh, okay. I've never read any of the Fables comics. So
very good comic. Excellent comic.
Well, and the show's pretty good, too. The only thing is the premise is built around once this main character who came in, who was the hot chick on House originally, once she figures out what's going on, she can actually break the spell and they all revert back to their normal lives. But right now, nobody knows that they're storybook characters.
Okay.
Basically,
so that's different. That's
she
different,
wins, maybe. The show's going to basically end because, you know, sure, everything goes right back and blah, blah, blah. So a lot of episodes end with her conniving and winning. There's not a lot of happy endings to the episodes, but, you know,
sure, right, in. Okay.
Pretty good show. So back to the Big Bang Theory. It's this show about these theoretical physicists who share an apartment.
And they're geeks.
Well, of course.
Yeah. Right.
Huge geeks. And they have two other buddies who are huge geeks, and they have interactions with the hot chick who moved in across the hallway.
Right, their neighbor, yeah.
And it is so dang funny. Yes, I said dang, with all the geek stuff that is thrown in. I mean, I've seen them playing Klingon Boggle.
Okay.
Kaplock. That's 8 points.
It's only the first season you've watched so far, right?
I'm almost completely through the second season at this point. And it keeps getting better. One of the main characters is this guy, Sheldon, and he's so, so good. I mean, the guy will rattle off 30 seconds of technical, theoretical physics jargon. Like, you know, he's talking about the weather and how he can pop all that out. Then they have their Halo night where they all got to get together and play Halo.
Sure.
The last episode I watched, they talked about playing Zork on vintage game night.
Oh, gosh. Infocom games, right?
Yes, exactly. Played that on the old Commodore 64, I believe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's comic book references.
Wasn't that on the VIC-20, too?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Originally VIC-20.
On a cartridge.
Yeah, right.
Big recommendation. It's very good.
Don't you feel kind of weird recommending a show that's a big hit anyway?
Is it a big hit?
Yeah, I think it's a pretty big hit.
Oh, I had no idea. I don't even know what season they're on, or even if it's still on.
Gosh, yeah, it's still on. I think they're in about their fifth season. Good, hey, you know what? Show. I want to throw out a real quick recommendation. There's a show out there maybe people that aren't familiar with. It's called 60 Minutes.
60 Minutes, eh?
Huh. Mm-hmm. Although it's really weird because I think the show itself outside of the commercials only runs about 48.
But you get to see the little clock ticking. So
that's right. Yes.
You know how long you were sitting there watching commercials.
Right. No, I just thought it was kind of strange that you're recommending a show that I would take a guess that many of the people in our audience probably already watch religiously. But no, that's fine. So what else is going on?
Oh, there were some huge tornadoes this week. You know, my sister-in-law's in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
They had tornado touchdown within a mile or two of their house, which took out an entire neighborhood.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Really, really scary. I don't know, man. The weather is really, really crazy now.
Yeah, come on, stop. What are you going to tell me? Global warming's the cause of this?
No, of course not. It's El Libre.
El Nino?
El Nino or Nina, whatever the one that it is.
Pinta, Nina, Santa Maria, that one?
Exactly.
Very unusual for this time of year to all of a sudden see tornadoes just touch down all throughout the country. I mean, it was all throughout. Yeah. It wasn't just one location. That was scary.
What kind of disasters do you guys get in Arizona? You don't get a lot of tornadoes, right?
No, we don't get anything like that. Disasters in Arizona? There really aren't, you know, a huge number of disasters. The heat, we get the wildfires.
Oh, there's one that counts.
Yeah, we get the wildfires, but that's not right around Phoenix. That's usually north of us. And it's a lot of times brought on by the government agencies themselves. So,
really?
It's usually not somebody who went camping and they were smoking or didn't put out their campfire or something like that. I think the last big big one we had was a controlled burn. Not unusual.
That went out of control?
Yep. Not unusual here. They have a controlled burn that burned out of control. Sometimes we'll see flash floods. We'll get hit by rain, which is very, very unusual here. And the streets and everything aren't made for that. Not like back east or even further west where you get rain. So you have sewer systems that can handle that kind of flow. And right. So there have been times in some of the smaller towns we'll get a downpour and small kids have actually been washed away in the flooding.
Jeez.
Yeah. But nothing to the extent of tornadoes or earthquakes or anything along those lines.
Gotcha.
It's pretty safe out here.
There you go. Except for the horribly uncomfortable heat.
Yes. Or if you imply that there are some game stores out here that would not support a game convention, yes, then it can be kind of dangerous. But outside of that, now you're fine.
That gets really uncomfortable.
I don't mind it.
All right. Should we head for the news?
I believe so. Let's bring on the news.
Good evening, Mr. Mrs. North and South America, and all the ships and clippers at sea. Let's go to France, flash.
The Hunger Games, brought to you by WizKids. Yes, the Hunger Games, which, to tell you the truth, I knew nothing about.
Until, I know very little about.
Yeah. There's a movie coming out March 23rd.
Yes.
But
it's based on a series of books.
Mm-hmm. WizKids has released several games based on the popular Scholastic book trilogy. And they're actually Scholastic books, so you know they're for young adults.
Mm-hmm.
And the soon-to-be-released movie. The Hunger Games takes place in the nation of Pan-Em, the post-apocalyptic North America. Each year, one boy and one girl from each of the 12 districts surrounding the capital are selected to fight to the death in an outdoor arena. Luckily, their children age 12 to 18, so there's no need to worry about toddler death battle movies yet.
Yet.
Right. The movie is, like I said, coming out March 23rd, but you can join in the fun early by picking up one of the new Hunger Games releases from WizKids. Training Days is a board game that places you in the role of one of the tributes during the training that leads up to the games. That's a strategy game for 2 to 6 players where players bid to win event cards, and as they win more events, their popularity rises. The goal of the game is to be the tribute who finishes training with the most popularity with the capital audience. Now, in the Jabberjay card game, each player represents a district citizen or capital citizen whose identity remains secret during most of the game. Players attempt to discover each other's identities and ultimately to force their opponents to flee. This card game is for 5 to 12 players, but interestingly enough, also includes a 2 to 4 player game where all players work cooperatively together to protect the district citizens from the peacekeepers. Can you work together to stop the capital from winning?
No.
No, probably not.
No, I'm too selfish.
Damn you. In the District 12 board game, you have to avoid the reaping by using your wits to acquire food, clothing, medicine, and fuel. You have to outplay your opponents to avoid being reaped. I'm not exactly sure what that means. I think that means you get selected as the chosen.
If you're someone who is a reaper, does that make you a reapist?
I think it might.
I know nothing about the Hunger Games, nor do I actually want to.
You know, I like to kind of keep up on my, you know, hip new pop culture stuff.
I understand. Yeah, well.
Contents include the game board, 55 resource cards, 9 special deck cards, 44 reaping cards, 4 player tokens, and 1 round token, 1 first action token, and 6 cover tokens, and it's for 2 to 4 players. And then finally, if you just want miniature figures, you can collect all 27 of the Hunger Games collectible figures, single booster figures.
Thank goodness.
Mm-hmm. You can collect every tribute, Gale, and 2 different versions of Katniss and Peeta. Those are the main characters.
Here I was thinking it was an animal rights group.
But, of course, these are blind boosters, so you'd better like the Hunger Games a whole lot to get the whole set.
Or you can wait till next year and go to a comic book convention and pick them up dirt cheap.
Right, for a quarter each.
I don't know. The whole the Hunger Games thing just smacks me as another Twilight. I don't know. It's not something I have any interest in. To me, it almost seems like it's a teenage The Running Man / Death Race 2000 kind of ripoff. Somebody will obviously prove me wrong. I don't know anything about the series. To me, I don't find it very original from what I've heard.
No clue. Like I said, it was originally novels made for young adults. tweens. Right. But there's nothing like good 12 to 18 year olds fighting to the death.
Which I find kind of weird too. I'm going to have to assume that whatever district they represent gets something out of it.
I don't know.
Maybe bigger food rations. I have no clue.
A Pizza Hut. You'll get the next Pizza Hut.
No, I think that would be something you wouldn't want to win.
All right, I'll go with Little Caesars.
Even worse.
$5, though.
Why don't you just say Tombstone Pizza Store?
What do you want on your tombstone?
I don't know. It depends on what district I'm from. For some reason, I think WizKids might be putting a few too many eggs in the Hunger Games basket.
I gotta swear you were gonna say Hungarian. I don't know why.
What, is that another country you want to tick off?
These are the Hungarian games.
Speaking of companies releasing licensed products, Upper Deck is going to release the Marvel Superhero Squad trading card game on April 24th. It's based on the popular gazillion Marvel Superhero Squad online player versus player card game, which is based on the Marvel Superhero Squad online cartoon. With themed intro packs based on classic characters, loot cards, redeemable rewards, and more, Marvel Superhero Squad, the TCG, offers gaming of heroic proportions. The 300-card base set comes in many guises, including intro packs, which will be based on Spider-Man, Wolverine, Iron Man, and the Hulk. Two-player intro packs that pitch the X-Men against the Avengers, and booster packs that are in a much more familiar format. It's important not to confuse the Marvel Superhero Squad trading card game with the Marvel Superstars trading card game that had been canceled but originally set for release early in 2010.
No, wait, wasn't there also another Marvel Superheroes card game aside versus, from that one?
Wasn't there the Versus system? I think they had DC yes. and Marvel. I know also recently the Marvel Superheroes role-playing game came out. So I'm interested in taking a peek of that because I'm hearing some good early indications about it.
Interesting. I'm looking forward to the Avengers movie. So.
Oh, yeah. The new trailer came out. It looks smoking, man.
Yeah.
It looks really good.
Excellent.
I would think it wouldn't be terrible because they've had all these other movies that they're building up to it. If the Avengers is a flop, man, that is going to be one serious buzzkill for the entire Marvel movie line.
Well, I'm sure it won't. It looks good so far.
It does. It looks pretty good. I thought Captain America was really good.
Yeah, I agree. I even liked Thor. It just wasn't as good as Captain America.
Yeah, Thor was all right. Just didn't have a whole lot of action in it.
No, but my wife liked it a lot because he was so hot.
Actually, I thought the guy was pretty... I can't remember the actor's name. I thought he was pretty good as Thor.
Man.
He came out of nowhere.
Uh-huh. I really liked how they made Steve Rogers look like such a wuss at the beginning.
It's CGI, baby.
I know it's CGI, but it's getting so good.
Yeah, it really is.
Because I could barely tell at all. Unless you're really, really trying to see that they've schnooshed him down.
Is that one of your words now? Snooshed?
I just pulled that one out. I've been snooshed.
You didn't pull that out. You made that up.
Well, there you go. Pulled out of the back of my head.
That wasn't where I was thinking, but go ahead.
Why the opposite? The Redhorn Gate is now on sale. It's the first adventure pack in the Daredevil cycle for Lord of the Rings, the living card game. The Redhorn Gate introduces a new hero and three copies of each player card, as well as a chilling new scenario that takes Middle-earth's heroes high into the Misty Mountains. Amid snowstorms, freezing cold, and predatory new foes, the heroes will find their resolve tested to the utmost. When some of Middle-earth's greatest heroes volunteer to escort Arwen Unodamiel, or whatever, to Rivendell, their voyage through the Redhorn Gate becomes the start of an epic new journey that will take them through bone-chilling snowstorms, hordes of enemies, and into the twists and turns of the entire Darrowdelf cycle. Snowstorms rage through the mountain passes, making travel difficult and crippling your fellowship's progress. And fearsome predators stalk the pass, ready to take advantage of any moment's weakness. But it is the discovery of a startling increase of orc activity that truly transforms the escort mission of the Redhorn Gate into the first chapter of an epic struggle against evil. The quests in the cycle are each meant to challenge players in new ways. Darrowdelph scenarios force players to reevaluate the flexibility of a deck and must have to handle all of the stuff that that deck throws out. See?
Mm-hmm.
So it's good. Some of the nastiest encounter cards to date appear in this cycle. So that's something for you to look forward to. The players also will have powerful new cards at their disposal as well, with 6 new hero cards, more strategies, and deck combinations that open up your eyes. The beginning of the cycles arc sets players on the path to Rivendell, and so it seemed fitting to provide players with cards that reflect this important elf haven, guarded under the wise and watchful rule of Elrond, who, of course, was recently from the Matrix trilogy.
Yes. Let's be honest. V for Vendetta.
He was in V for Vendetta?
Yeah, he's V.
Oh, well, you never see him.
Well, no, but it's his voice.
Oh, okay. I didn't even know that. I like him, though. He's a good actor. This thrilling adventure pack is available now at your local retailer and the FFG web store.
Speaking of Fantasy Flight Games, they're now expanding the classic Talisman game universe with an exciting new expansion, which is themed on one of Elliot's favorite themes, Gothic horror.
Ooh.
The Blood Moon will offer over 100 new adventure cards, plus spells, characters, and alternate endings. Will you capture the Crown of Command? Once in a generation, the Blood Moon begins its fell cycle, bathing the realm in a pallid light. Compelled by its sinister presence, the restless dead rise from their graves. Vampires hunt for unwary prey, and witches engage in nocturnal rituals. Worse yet, the horrifying werewolf prowls the night, seeking heroes with whom to share his curse. Fantasy Flight Games is pleased to announce the upcoming release of The Blood Moon. In addition to a host of new challenges, the Blood Moon introduces 2 engaging mechanics, or at least engaging according to FFG. Time alternates between day and night, and a bloodthirsty werewolf prowls the land. I'm not sure why the werewolf is so much scarier than undead and vampires and witches.
I don't know. You're given a choice.
Yeah, I don't know. The Blood Moon should shine its eerie light into stores sometime in the second quarter of 2012.
Ah, nice. Have you ever played Talisman? I think I remember playing the original one years ago.
Think we did play the original one long, long ago, long before it was FFG.
Yeah.
In fact, off the top of my head, I can't even tell you who it might have been. It might have actually been Games Workshop. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. Fleet. A card game of commercial fishing. Actually, this is getting quite a lot of interest.
This is on Kickstarter, isn't it?
Yes, yes. On Kickstarter right now is Fleet, the commercial fishing card game designed by Matthew Riddle, which is no relation to Tom, and Ben Pinchback in the northwest corner of Nunavut, Canada. A formerly inaccessible bay off the Arctic Ocean has become reachable through a secret inlet. Untouched by the hands of time and fed by both the ocean and warm freshwater springs, Ridback Bay is teeming with sea life. A remote, timeless bayside village is being inundated by entrepreneurs awaiting the influx of the world's greatest fishermen to harvest this plentiful bounty. The docks and warehouses are being revitalized, and now it's time to begin the real adventure. Go build your fleet and become the master of the seas. I am the master of the seas.
I'm going fishing. I'm going to be the master. I will be the masturbator.
Yes, I am sure you will. In this game, you must acquire licenses, launch boats, and fish the great briny blue. The player who manages his or her resources and acquires the most victory points via fish licenses and boats will build the strongest fleet and lead his crew to victory. The game has already reached its Kickstarter goal and will be published by Griffin Games. The biggest reason to kickstart the game now, yeah?
No, go ahead.
Is that if you pledge $25, you'll also receive the Salty Captain's promotional set of 8 cards. The Salty Captain is a unique card that can be purchased during any higher captain's phase by any player. It's the only card in Fleet that works that way, and it's a great way to maximize your boats. The Salty Captains can be purchased instead of using a boat card as a captain. The Salty Captains allow a boat to catch 2 crates of fish per fishing phase and hold 8 fish instead of just 4. Plus, you'll receive the Salvage Yard license set of 4 cards, which will only be available through the Kickstarter program. Salvage Yard integrates into the license deck and adds a new way to generate cash for players to choose to use it. Salvage Yard allows players to salvage a boat card from their hand for its cash value in new boat cards. It's a powerful way to generate cash, but must be used wisely, as it counts as a launch. If you're interested in the commercial fishing theme, Fleet is on Kickstarter right now, and the estimated release date is September 2012.
Jeez. I wanted to mention that I kind of chuckled when you were talking about Fleet. Not necessarily because of the game itself, but when you mentioned that it's on Kickstarter, it's from Griffin, right away it jumped in my head. These are guys who do not belong on Kickstarter. And I'm not going to go into a whole thing about Kickstarter again, because it's starting to win me over. But Eagle Games, Griffin Games, they don't belong there. That'd be like saying, well, Fantasy Flight Games has this new game and it's on Kickstarter. People have to realize Griffin Games, Eagle Games, they're owned by the same guy who owns Fun Again Games. I was at Vulcan. Eagle / Griffin was there.
Yeah.
Remember the road to Canterbury?
Yeah.
That we had covered, and you said, wow, that sounds really interesting, and it was on Kickstarter and blah, 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 right?
Yeah.
Well, they had it there. They were practically giving it away. When I receive news items from Eagle / Griffin, it's never, hey, this is a new game coming out or anything like that. I get the same stuff that goes out to their retailers. And it wasn't too long ago. In fact, I even posted this in our Save Money on Games. There were about 30 titles that they contacted the retailers and said, oh, stock levels are awfully low. This is going to be your last chance to get your hands on these games. It wasn't the stock level is really low. It was, we aren't going to reprint this because, to be honest, most of these games are crap.
Did they say that in the email?
No, that's what it is in reality.
Right.
I hate the fact that these guys now go to Kickstarter, so they have absolutely no investment and no risk on their part to produce any games. That's what it boils down to.
And it's not what it's intended for, you're correct.
No, it is not. I'm going to just make a big, broad statement here, and it's going to get me in trouble. And to be honest, I don't really care. If you see a Griffin or Eagle game on Kickstarter, buyer beware.
My God. I can hear people typing now.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, that's my opinion, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, there you go. I'm fine with that.
I figured you would be. New from High Flying Dice Games comes A Bold Fight and Courage Under Fire. A Bold Fight details the decisive Battle of Mobile Bay fought on August 5th, 1864. One of the most violent and decisive naval battles of the American Civil War, has players use a standard deck of cards to activate their warships and fortress batteries to resolve combat such as gunnery, ramming, and torpedoes and mines. What are you talking about? Damn the torpedoes. Full speed ahead. Play is very interactive and intense, but without any of the tedious record keeping of many naval games. And this retails for $11.95.
Oh.
Courage Under Fire is a low complexity, low counter density game on the assault on An Lập during the North Vietnamese Easter Offensive in 1972. The NVA launched the Easter Offensive, and the village of An Lập became a critical objective as it was astride Highway QL-13 halfway between a large base area in Cambodia and the city of Saigon. On or around April 12th, the North Vietnamese began a 7,000-round-a-day bombardment and launched attacks beginning on April 13th. Under attack by two NVA and one Viet Cong division, a total of about 35,000 men, the Arvin 5th Division, along with Arvin Airborne and Ranger units, which numbered about 7,500, held off the continued assault by infantry and tanks with the help of U.S. airstrikes and B-52 arc-like bombings. The game uses area movement and interesting chromes such as NVA sappers, variable applications for artillery bombardment, and of course airstrikes, as the Arvin is hard-pressed to duplicate the efforts of the 5th Infantry. Courage Under Fire is available for $5.95 from High Flying Dice Games. Also in wargaming news, new from Worthington Games comes Mercury Market Garden. And it's a Battle Command series game covering two great battles. Mercury, which was the invasion of Crete, as a two-player game that simulates the first 10 days of Operation Mercury from May 20th to May 29th, 1941. Market Garden Race for the Rhine is a two-player game that simulates the first 10 days of Operation Market Garden, which most of us who know our history understand it was the Allied airborne invasion of Holland, and the action simulates September 17th to September 26th, 1944. The price for Mercury / Market Garden is $50.
Lords of Waterdeep from Wizards of the Coast is coming soon. Waterdeep, the City of Splendors, the most resplendent jewel in the Forgotten Realms.
La 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 la.
And a den of political intrigue and shady back alley dealings.
What is it, Chicago?
Right. You know, that actually popped into my head. In this game, the players are powerful lords vying for control of this great city. Its treasures and resources are ripe for the taking, and that which cannot be gained through trickery and negotiation must be taken by force. Lords of Waterdeep is a strategy board game for 2 to 5 players. You take on the role of one of the masked lords of Waterdeep, secret rulers of the city. Through your agents, you recruit adventurers to go on quests on your behalf, earning rewards and increasing your influence over the city. Expand the city by purchasing new buildings that open up new actions on the board and hinder or help the other lords by playing intrigue cards to enact your carefully laid plans. Lords of Waterdeep is due to be released March 20th with an MSRP of $49.99. Yes.
My master plan.
Master plan. A new Wizards of the Coast board game.
Which sounds a little bit different than some of their other D&D based games.
Yeah, it does.
Kind of sounds a little more Euro.
I wonder if they have victory points. We'll see.
I'm sure there are. How else are you going to win?
By trickery and negotiation.
That never happens. Spartan Games has announced the release of an updated version of the rulebook for its steampunk-themed miniatures combat game, Dystopian Wars. The new rulebook refines gameplay for the system that first launched in 2011. Those purchasing the updated rulebook can take advantage of one of two special offers. The latest edition brings together a number of key changes to the rules system, refinement of the rules text, and tweaks to the stat cards of certain models, all of which enhance the game and deliver a better tournament experience. I'd be a little more concerned with my experience just playing at home with my friends than in a tournament. Rules for the original nations are presented clearly and concisely, backed with some beautiful illustrations of the characters and ships that inhabit this Victorian sci-fi age. Of course, the Edition 1.1 Master Rulebook is still fully compatible with the Covenant of Antarctica and the New Republic of France A5 Fleet Guides.
Oh, Republic.
No. Hey, do you want to buy a used French battleship?
Cheap.
Never fired, only sailed once. The first offer that you have available to you is to pick up the new Master Rulebook at your local game store for 25% off the normal price. Just simply pick up a copy with a 25% off sticker. And you better hope that your friendly local gaming store has a 25% off sticker on it. Alternately, customers buying Edition 1.1 directly from the Spartan Games online store will receive their first mercenary naval model, Captain Vladimir Nikonov. Nov's formidable submersible, the Black Wolf. So you have a choice of 25% off if you're just being introduced to the game, or you can get a free model if you already have the game. Nice thing, too, is the new 1.1 edition is going to be available for people who already have the game as a PDF download, and gaming stores will carry a booklet in the future that will have all the rule changes as well, so you don't have to buy the new book.
Unless you're a completist and you just want the new book.
Yes, unless you're a completist, yes. Hmm. But I thought that was pretty cool.
That is actually a pretty cool thing.
Because a lot of times, especially with the miniature games and that, when they do a new update to the rules, there isn't a huge difference. But let's say Games Workshop, when they do it, oh man, you have to go out and you have to buy the whole new book. All the supplements that you have no longer correspond, so they expect you to buy all that stuff too.
You have to melt down all your old figures.
Yep. Melt them into slag.
Well, Jeff, you know, World War II's Wings of Glory hits the stores on March 7th.
Dun, dun, dun.
The first airplane packs arrived at Ares Warehouse in the U.S. and are now shipping to distributors. The new Wings of Glory game will debut in the USA in March with the release of the new World War II airplane packs featuring 4 aircraft, the Curtiss P-40 Warhawk, the Yakolev Yak-1, the Kawasaki Ki-60, and the Regain RE-2001 Falco, each presented in two different versions.
That is pretty funny that the last plane you mentioned is an Italian fighter.
Yes. Well, it's an Italian company, you know.
Yes, I understand that, but I do think that's a little interesting there.
The airplane packs already arrived in the Ares Game warehouse in U.S. and are now shipping to the distributors and will be available in the store starting on March 7th, right around the corner. In Europe, the arrival on the shelves is scheduled for the following week. The World War II Wings of Glory series is an easy, fun-to-play, fast, and furious system that recreates aerial combat of that time, with innovative game mechanics that encompass planes with very different flight capabilities and firepower, while still keeping the flow of the combat simple and fun. Created by Andrea Agolino and Pier Giorgio Paglia, the game was formerly published with the name Wings of War, and has thousands of fans worldwide. I actually do own it.
The World War II version?
No. World War I. I like my dog fighting in the Great War.
The war to end all wars.
Yeah, that one. Never worked.
Yeah, it didn't stick, did it?
No.
You don't have any of the planes, though, do you?
I used to, but then I sold them on eBay because they became worth a lot of money.
Okay.
Each airplane pack features a ready-to-play model, painted and assembled with a special base with gaming stats, a variable altitude flying stand, and specific deck of maneuver cards. It's not a complete game, so it's necessary to have World War II Wings of Glory starter set to play, which will be released in the next few weeks, or an old set of World War II game system. It's completely compatible with them. The suggested retail price for the airplane packs is $12.90. Look for yours on March 7th.
If you're a fan of Pathfinder and you're planning on going to Gen Con, then why not help Pathfinder and Paizo out and attend Gen Con absolutely free?
Did you say free?
I said free.
Wow.
And I know you like free.
I do.
Currently, Paizo is scheduling 750 tables of Pathfinder Society action over the four-day convention. They're also bringing their GM 101 workshop that debuted at PaizoCon to Gen Con as well. They're looking to draw in new players and GMs to Pathfinder, as well as make active Pathfinder Society players take the next step and help GMs in their own home regions. They also have an invitation-only second round to the Gen Con special Race for the Rune Carved Key. The first round will be what you have come to know and love about Pathfinder specials. There's only 75 tables all working together to overcome some nasty problem that needs to be dealt with. If you're interested in running some Pathfinder events, by all means, go to the Paizo.com website. Check out the special rules involved for being able to GM for them. And you can find not only getting your own four-day badge absolutely free, but at some levels, they'll even put you up in a hotel room that you share with three other people.
Huh, not bad. But I hear that you must bring them a shrubbery.
No, I didn't hear that.
Oh, okay. Sorry, that must have been something else.
But I do think it's pretty cool that not only are you going to get a free badge for doing this, and I think you have to devote a good amount of time running Pathfinder stuff. They're right. Not going to say, well, you know, run a two-hour session and you can hang out on us. But I thought it was pretty cool that they'll actually put you up in a 1/4 of a hotel room, as they put it, if you do sign up for a specific level of support for Pathfinder.
Yeah, it is cool.
There you have it for the news for this time around, and let's move on to the reviews.
And now it's time for the Gaming Gang's game reviews. Try saying that 10 times fast.
I'm not going to try.
The first game that I'm going to review is Nature of the Beast from Eye Level Entertainment. Designed by Mark and Matthew Anticole, it actually came out in 2005. Which is interesting. It's for 2 to 4 players.
Why is it interesting that it came out in 2005?
Well, because I haven't heard of it before a month ago, so.
There's a lot of stuff we've never heard of or never played.
Yeah, but this one was actually interesting.
Yeah, I know.
Nature of the Beast is a card game, and it currently comes in 2 different flavors. It's the City versus Suburbs box and the Farm versus Forest box. And each of these boxes contains 2 decks, which is enough for 2 players to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
The main difference is, of course, the types of animals in each deck, as is apparent by the name. The premise is that you're building an animal army which is fighting for total domination of the animal kingdom.
Yes!
We win! You'll be recruiting animals from your deck to play into your field, which is an imaginary 3x3 card layout in front of you. And once you fill your field with animals, you win the game. What surprised me about the game is the complexity. For a simple card game, there's a lot going on. So it isn't actually simple at all. There's two pre-built decks in each box, and each deck consists of tricks and troops. The troops are the animals that you'll be recruiting to your army, and the tricks are the many other actions that you can perform in the game. Each troop card has several statistics. Combat is their combat strength, clout is their ability to recruit other animals, and cunning is their intelligence. The main stat is their rank. The higher the rank, the better the animal. There's also some secondary stats, such as their habitat, like city, suburbs, farm, and forest, their size, and their movement type. These stats apply mainly to different trick cards or animal abilities. Each troop card also has up to 8 small arrows in the corners and the cardinal points, and these are called vectors and indicate in which directions the animal can move about on the field. If there's no arrow, the animal can't move in that direction.
Finally, or support or attack.
Yes, exactly. And finally, each animal has a picture, name, special ability, and some flavor text. The artwork's not bad, but my favorite is the flavor text. There's some good stuff there. It's easy to ignore the text if you're in the middle of a game, but I recommend that you read them over. Some of them are funny. Most are at least amusing. I was scratching my head for a moment when I ran across the H2 orangutans, and then I laughed out loud when I realized that they were sea monkeys.
Right.
The tricks come in several different flavors, too. Location cards can be added to a spot on your field that add a bonus or ability to that spot. Ally cards are humans that you can recruit. These are placed next to a row, and they provide a special ability to that row. Leader cards are attached to one of your animals and add rank to that animal plus an ability. Event cards mostly affect battles, and item cards are attached to animals to give them various bonuses, like giving, you know, a squirrel a can of spray paint. Initially, you start the game with 3 tricks and 3 troops laid out face down in your pen. Your pen is a row of 3 cards just below your field, and this is where your animals move out of when they're recruited. On your turn, you flip over up to all 3 cards in your pen. You get to draw tricks for each troop card that you don't flip over, and then you get to perform 3 actions. The main one is recruiting an animal. To recruit, you need to use enough clout to equal or better the rank of the animal that you wish to recruit. To do this, you can either trash animals that are in your pen to use their clout, or tilt, which is tapping to you magic enthusiasts.
Hey, hey, you can't say that.
Now we're going to get sued.
Tilting, not tapping.
Right. To animals in your field to use their clout, or you can do a combination of the two. Once you've obtained enough clout, you move the recruited animal onto your field by following the movement arrows, the vectors. If the space in your field isn't open, then you can't move the animal there, so you need to keep the back row of your field as open as you possibly can. Other actions include moving an animal in your field, drawing a trick card, untilting an animal, because they don't untilt automatically, move an animal back into your deck, and declare a battle. Now, the battles are fairly simple. You declare which animal is attacking which other animal on your opponent's field. The defender can play cards to add to their defense, then the attacker can play cards. You can enlist allies from the animals surrounding the attacker to give yourself a combat bonus, and then you compare the final combat numbers. The attacker wins if their combat total beats the defender's total, and the losing animal is trashed. Regardless of the outcome, the attacker gains 1 point of fury. There is a card which keeps track of favor and fury by using pennies on the card. If you ever hit 10 fury points, you lose the game.
That's right.
Yeah.
We humans aren't going to put up with that kind of nonsense.
That's right. The humans take notice of you and wipe you all out. Favor is used to play various item cards onto your animals. There's a few actions that are free, like calling a human ally, claiming a location, or playing an item. On top of this, each animal has a special ability, which are all very different. Gameplay rotates to each player in turn and continues until a player wins by filling his field with recruited animals, or only one player remains when the other players lose due to having too much fury. And as you can see, there's a lot going on and a lot of options. It actually got a bit confusing trying to keep track of all of the abilities and options with the various trick cards. I'm sure it'll become easier over time as you learn the cards, but it will take a few plays to get the feel for it. Once this happens, you can try assembling your own deck using the included deck building rules. You can build up some powerful combos, but you might need a few decks to do it. At least you know what is included in every box of cards that you buy. There's no worrying about buying a bunch of boosters to get the cards that you need. I like this game. It had a lot more depth than I was anticipating, and I'll just bet a group of Magic players would get a kick out of Nature of the Beast. I enjoy the dark/funny theme with cute animals that can be deadly. High Level is currently kickstarting, actually, the next set of decks for the game, and that's called Prairie vs. Polar, and that's going on right now for the next week or so.
I believe there's 10 days left to it as we record. Once the show hits, there's 9 days left.
Mm-hmm. And I did play it, and I do like the game. Like I said, it's got a lot more depth to it than I would have originally thought, and there's some good humor in there, too.
I enjoyed the artwork. I thought the artwork's pretty good. Flavor text, yeah, some of it's funny. There are a few other aspects about the game. Is because it's, for an example, like the Kickstarter is Prairie versus Polar, you also have these terrain cards that you'll use and various different creatures, depending on what terrain they're used to, will actually be more effective in that area than in other areas. Plus the vectors, I thought the vectors coming into play was very interesting as well.
Yeah, you're right. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Because your field is basically a 9-square 3x3 grid.
Mm-hmm.
So how you maneuver your animals in that grid is important too, because if you are being attacked by the other player and you have animals behind that can't support or defend in that vector, then you're kind of out of luck.
Yeah.
So there's a lot involved there as well. One thing I really have to say I despised about this game was the rule book.
Yeah,
the
it's rule funny. Book, it was a lot longer rule book than I thought it would be, you know?
It's not the length of the rule book or anything like that. It's the size of the rule book. It's the print font of the rule book. The print font is tiny.
Yeah, it's if definitely tiny.
Yes, if I were 15 years old, sure, I'd have no issue probably reading it. Being 44 years old, there was a major issue trying to read it. I'm not sure if High Level Entertainment has the rulebook available for download on their website. Mm-hmm. I would hope they do. I would have had a much easier time processing the rulebook if it wasn't in this itty-bitty tiny font. And a lot of the pictures that they'll have as well will have some explanations to it and arrows pointing to different features of the cards. You can barely make it out.
Yeah. It's definitely hard to read. I had to do that thing where I pulled my glasses down to the end of my nose, yeah. Like I'm Benjamin Franklin or something.
Or take a magnifying glass practically to figure it out.
Yeah, I'm not ready to admit that I need to get a pair of readers yet.
I'm almost to that point, or I believe that's probably going to be coming up soon.
Yeah, luckily with the Kindle, I can make the font size bigger.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons why having something downloadable would be great. And I'm not knocking if they do or don't. They may actually have it.
Yeah, they might. I don't know.
Yeah, they probably do, to be honest. I just haven't looked. But as far as the Kickstarter project, it's at about 84% financing right now. And as an interesting little side note, if you do pledge them, regardless of what level, it could be $1, it could be $50, doesn't matter, you can vote on your favorite podcast.
Yes, and
the podcasters will be immortalized in a card for that set.
That is very true. You know,
yes.
And I was going to mention it. I thought about mentioning it. I wavered. Right now, I'm the only one voting for the Gaming Gang. But there's only like, I don't know, 5 votes right now.
I think there's 5. I didn't, well, at least I haven't at this point, because I figured I'd just sit back and see how things start to play out as far as that. Well, and to be honest, we're not necessarily the biggest guys about pimping the Gaming Gang either.
No, I know. I just thought it would be cool.
Well, I'm completely with you on that.
And I'm behind the game because it is fun.
It is. It's a lot of fun. It's a really good game. And it's a very, very good card game that sort of came out of left field as far as we knew.
Exactly. I think it runs for $17.95.
Yes, it's not an expensive game either.
Yeah. Nature of the Beast.
My first review is Nexus Ops from Fantasy Flight Games. It's for 2 to 4 players, originally released back in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
2005, there you go. That's a good year so far on the review.
A look back at 2005 with the Gaming Gang.
Nexus Ops is a lighter sort of sci-fi, which I know Elliot loves that term. I'm not a big one. I like to say science fiction war game, which was initially made available through Avalon Hill / Wizards of the Coast back in 2005. From my understanding, the title was fairly popular and can still be easily found on the secondary market. Now we turn the calendar to 2012, and Fantasy Flight Games has an all-new edition which had landed on store shelves late last year. For fans of the game, this is both good and bad. I'll be the first to point out I'd never played the Avalon Hill edition, so this game was completely new to me.
Yeah, me too.
I will mention that gamers I had join me during the review playthroughs did own copies of the first edition, and they had real issues with the FFG presentation. Originally, Nexus Ops was fairly over the top, at least from what I've seen, in some of its presentation in regards to oddball artwork and the miniatures and so forth. In this new edition, FFG has gone with a more straightforward, and I'll be very honest, somewhatly gloomy art style. I have no issue with this simply because I'm not familiar with the previous edition.
Right.
I don't have any preconceived notion about what Nexus Ops should be. One thing I was made aware of during the game sessions is that Fantasy Flight Games has left the core of the gameplay intact with simply more optional rules that can come into play. This was apparent the moment I opened the box and saw the rulebook is 12 pages in length. What's that, you say? An FFG title with only 12 pages of rules? Yep, the core rules actually only take up 8 pages, and most are devoted to photos and examples of play. It's certain, looking at this, that Fantasy Flight Games did not take the original game, kitbash it to fit their own model of game design, and release a completely unrecognizable game, as they have done on some occasions in the past. This is a good thing because the game plays great. Each player represents one of 4 different corporations looking to mine a mysterious foreign resource called rubium, which now powers how we go about living our lives, at least in this future setting. The corporations do so by exploiting the local alien life forms that they find on the planet they've discovered that has huge resources of rubium, and these life forms do their bidding across the landscape. Each player has a home base from which they send humans, fungoids, lava leapers, and other native creatures across a modular hex map which surrounds a central mysterious monolith. The goal is to set up new mines in order to finance new and more powerful units. Players also have secret missions they can fulfill to earn victory points. Game setup's fairly easy as you simply shuffle up the terrain tiles face down and place them around the central monolith tile while you shuffle the 3 decks: Energize, Secret Missions, and Battle Victories. Once the tiles are in place, you'll now flip them right side up so the terrain types are revealed. Next, you take exploration tokens, which you also shuffle face down, and place them on each appropriate hex. One player gets to be the first player and remains so throughout the game. Players receive their starting amount of rubium, and each player following the first gets an increasing amount to offset the disadvantage of activating later in the turn. After this, you're pretty much good to go, and for most people, 10 or at most 15 minutes is about right for getting set up. Each turn plays out in a sequence of phases, as each player will perform all of their actions before the next player begins their turn. You have the deployment phase. Simply enough, the active player uses any or all rubium they possess to purchase new units and place them on any of their 3 home base tiles. If a player has an energized card, which can be played in the deployment phase, they can do so as well. Movement phase. Each player then moves their units. Each unit only moves once. Most only move 1 hex, but some do move further, and units cannot move through an enemy-controlled or contested tile without stopping. Then you have the exploration phase. If units have moved into a location that still has a face-down exploration token, that token is turned face-up. The token may feature a creature, a refinery, or both. If it's a creature, then you take that type of creature from your unused supply and place it on that tile. Hey, you got a new recruit. Rude. And now you can use that as you would any other unit on a following turn.
By killing.
Yeah, for killing, because that's what you're doing.
Sure, hey.
Although some units you use to actually mine the rubium. If you find a refinery, you leave the token face up, and this becomes a new location in which you can mine. If the token shows both, you simply perform both actions. Then you have the battle phase. The active player now conducts combat in all contested hexes that you have units present. Units attack in order of their power, so more powerful units will attack first, followed by the next powerful, then the next, and so on. Both attacker and defender will roll simultaneously for each type of unit, and a hit is scored if the attack number or higher is rolled on a six-sided die. The owning player then removes a unit of their choice for every hit and returns it back to their supply. Some energized cards can be played during battles, as well as various units have special abilities that you can activate. Once all unit types have fought, if no defending units remain, the attacker has won the battle and receives a battle victory card.
Woo.
Yeah, that's victory points. That's how you win.
How many?
It's all based 12. But I'll get to that.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It's not necessarily how much rubium you control. The rubium is just the fuel that you use to power your war machine, really. If you lose and you're the defender, you actually get to draw an energized card. If all units mutually eliminate each other, it's still considered a victory for the attacker. If attacking and defending units still remain, then it's neither a win nor a loss, and the battle is over for the turn, but may, and most likely will, continue later in another player's turn. If the battle meets the conditions of one of a player's secret mission cards, they can now play that card and receive more victory points.
I'd love victory points.
That's how you win the game.
Sorry.
No, just say that's how you win. Then you have the mining phase. The player collects the number of rubium tokens from the mines he controls and the hexes that a miner unit is occupying. Not all units can mine, so this is something to consider when you're battling it out over a refinery location. This rubium's added to your supply so you can purchase new units in your next deployment phase. Finally, you have the draw phase. The active player draws one secret mission card, and if those conditions are met, they can even play that immediately. If the card can't be played, you hold it, and hopefully you can complete that later in the game. And it's played immediately whenever those conditions have been met. If the player also controls that central monolith, they draw two energized cards. Both energize and secret mission cards can be exchanged for one rubium each and then are discarded into the discard piles.
Abyss.
Yes, to the abyss. Then it's on to the next player. The game ends once any player has reached 12 victory points or any one player has been eliminated. A player is eliminated if they A, have no units on the board, and B, don't have enough rubium to purchase more units on their turn, even if they were to exchange cards for rubium. If the game ends after a player elimination, then the player with the most victory points wins. There are various tiebreakers in place as well, so very rarely will you see the game end in a draw based upon player elimination. The Fantasy Flight Games Edition also includes quite a few optional rules, such as extra exploration tiles, team play, optional units, and more. I have to say, I really enjoyed Nexus Ops, and I highly recommend anyone who doesn't already have a copy of the original to race out and pick up this game. Sure, there's a bit of that Risk atmosphere to it, but there's quite a bit more depth. I'd say it falls probably somewhere between Risk and Axis and Allies on the scale of complexity. I especially like the fact that the game plays quickly enough and the battles don't just bog down into tons of units slogging away until only one side remains. This has a tremendous effect of speeding up downtime, as there will be lots of battles, but they only last one round. Especially interesting is when you have more than two players contesting an important piece of real estate, as one player can move into the hex hot and heavy to smash one opponent, only to find themselves whittled away, leaving themselves very easy pickings for the forces of the unengaged opponent. A clever player in a 3 or 4 player game can find themselves in a great position to carve up the soft underbelly all around the map if two or more players find themselves in a meat grinder situation over a hex or two. Controlling the monolith can be a great asset, but in my opinion, not at the cost of continually battling over it when units can be better served mining that sweet, sweet rubium.
I love it.
That's good. Obviously, the game will come across as way too light for those more in the mood for a longer or more epic game along the lines of a Twilight Imperium. But for those gamers who want a multiplayer bash-up that doesn't boil down into a never-ending stalemate, you know, that one man left standing slog like Risk or Ikuza, within a 90-minute playtime, Nexus Ops is very welcome. I don't have a beef with the FFG decision to go with a different art style simply because I'm not intimately familiar with the previous edition, and I really don't concern myself too much with the looks of a game because if it plays great, it plays great. That's all that matters. If I can give high marks to the ugliest game I can remember ever seeing, Baltimore and Ohio, I certainly can't knock FFG for the dingier or grittier look of their version of Nexus Ops. If you already own the previous Avalon Hill edition, I don't know if there's really enough here to warrant a new purchase, as not much has changed outside of some additional optional rules and the visual style of the game. However, if you don't already have Nexus Ops and you enjoy multiplayer games with a bit of an epic feel, you'll surely want to add this new Fantasy Flight edition of Nexus Ops to your collection.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious, and stop calling me Shirley.
Sorry, I had to.
Of course. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a very, very good game.
Excellent.
Everything in war is very simple, but the simplest thing is difficult. Carl von Clausewitz from his book on war. New from the father of Victory Point Games' Napoleonic 20 series, renowned game designer Joe Miranda, the von Clausewitz series, brings you the great campaigns of what historians call the long 19th century, that period between the French Revolution and World War I. The series seeks to faithfully demonstrate how war was thought about and waged during this era. It features quick, streamlined gameplay, simple but not simplistic mechanics, card play, and the fog of war. Unique to the series and following the theories of Clausewitz himself, players must be aware that many of their actions will build friction points, which a wily opponent can then use against them to sabotage their best laid plans. Careful management of reserves and reinforcements, clever card play, and knowing when to throw caution to the wind to strike an opponent will win the day. First game of the von Clausewitz series is Franco-Prussian War 40, two continental heavyweights duel for supremacy in the conflict that smashed the French Second Empire, triggered the Paris Commune, and birthed the German Reich. Will the war end in the streets of Paris or Berlin? The fate of Europe hangs in the balance in Franco-Prussian War 40, now available from Victory Point Games.
Victory Point Games, where the gameplay is the thing.
I thought you were going to do the mean voice.
Victory Point Games, where the gameplay's the thing. My second review is going to be on Star Trek Fleet Captains from WizKids, designed by Mike Elliott, Brian Kinsella, and Ethan Pasternak. Came out in 2011. It's for two or four players. Takes about an hour, hour and a half to play. When you pull the cover off the box for Star Trek Fleet Captains, the first thing you notice is the smell of chemical plastic, which can mean component bliss to some and nausea to others.
Or both.
Or both. I was not disappointed. I was greeted with a plethora of cards, tokens, and the ships. There's 24 of them, each pressed into their own individual molded space in the box to hold them in place firmly, along with a piece of foam to cover them and protect them.
You're talking about the ships.
Exactly. The ships are nice. They're mounted on clear plastic stands, which are set on top of the black HeroClix bases. None of my ships were broken, and all of the bases that I had clicked with no problem. I've seen a lot of complaints that wasn't the case, but mine was perfect.
I have seen some cases with HeroClix overall, regardless of what the title is, that the dials don't click or they're almost impossible to click.
Yeah, I guess there is a solution for that, for fixing that, that you can find over on WordGameGeek. But with this one, I didn't have any problem. I went and individually tried every single ship, even though I haven't played with every ship yet, just to make sure that they all work right, and they were all fine. The cards are thinner than I'm used to, but they are still of good quality, and they're the silkscreen type.
Mm-hmm.
The location tiles, though, are of the same material, and I personally would have preferred normal cardstock tiles, because these really won't lay completely flat, but the one benefit thing is that they are easy to shuffle. This is a game for two or four players, and you can choose the Federation or the Klingon side. Setting up the game was an interesting process. It does take some time, but it's enjoyable. You have to shuffle and lay out the hexagon tiles on the table in whatever pattern of space you wish to explore. They do have a standard layout for you to use, or you can just make up your own.
Mm-hmm.
You start with all the tiles face down as you have the whole galaxy to explore. The players set up a command module along one edge where they will launch their fleets from. And speaking of fleets, each ship has cards associated with it. The cards have the values of the HeroClix dials on them, including settings for weapons, shields, sensors, and engines. There's three levels within these settings, one each for normal, yellow alert, and red alert.
If you're...
red alert! Red alert! If your ship takes a point of damage, you have to click the dial over to the yellow alert section. At that point, you're restricted to the settings in this section while the ship has one point of damage. Another point of damage will bring you to red alert status, and a third point will destroy your ship. The cards also list a size for the ship, and this is what is used to build your fleet. The players choose a fleet size for the game. Normally, this is 10 points, but you can adjust it for a shorter or a longer game. The players start flipping over ship cards and adding up the size points until they reach the correct total exactly. You may need to go through the deck more than once, but eventually all the players end up with random fleets that add up to a uniform size.
Really?
Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting. I like how they do that. At this point, you'll be selecting your command cards. Each side has 10 separate stacks of 10 cards each, themed around some aspect of Trek or mission types. You see, you'll be selecting a stack of 10 mission cards. The missions are separated into combat, influence, and science missions. Each ship lists the types of missions that they're used for, and you draw mission cards from the appropriate stacks based on the ships that you have. You don't know what the missions are, but you know what they'll basically involve. Then you'll select four stacks of command cards that are geared toward the types of missions that you'll be facing. For example, they have the Captain Kirk deck, or the Main Engineering deck, and you shuffle these cards to form your command deck, which you'll draw and play from during the game. Finally, you're ready to play. Flip over three of the mission cards. If it's a secret mission, make sure to read it and flip it back face down so your opponent can't see it. On your turn, you can move all of your ships up to their engine power value. Each location tile has a size value that indicates how many movement points it will take to cross it. To move to an adjacent tile, it's only one movement point. If it's unexplored, you have to flip it over and see what's there. You might find a quasar, or a nebula, or a habitable planet, or a dreaded black hole, among other things. There's an encounter value on each tile, and you have to roll a die to see if you have an encounter. If you do, you draw an encounter card and you resolve it. Sometimes they're good, and sometimes not. There are even some that will provide a victory point for you if it's resolved. I should mention that the object of the game is to score a certain number of victory points by completing missions.
Victory points? What are those?
I know, I've never heard of those before. The amount is determined by the size of the fleet you started the game with, so in a standard 10-point fleet size game, you'll need to get 10 victory points to win. You will slowly expand from your command base to explore the space around you, while also attempting to complete the missions that you've drawn. You can adjust the dials on your ships once each turn, so if you need to boost the engines, that's how you'll do it. Be careful, though. Adding power to one value means it will decrease for another value. Power up the engines, and you might have to sacrifice your shields. There's a lot of other things you can do on your turn. You can play command cards or perform a test, and this is how you accomplish many of your missions, and is in effect a skill check using a value from one of your ship systems, plus a die roll to meet or beat a certain number, like a level 20 sensor check, for example. You can also perform three actions from this big list of actions. These include attacking another ship, exerting influence in a location, building an installation on a habitable planet, engaging a cloaking device, creating a sensor echo to hide from your enemies, repairing a damaged ship, calling up reinforcements, sending off an away team, adding a crew member to a ship, and so on. Adding a crew member is really cool because some of your command cards are characters from the various Star Trek TV series that can be permanently attached to a ship and provide some excellent bonuses.
So I could get Wesley Crusher?
You could, which would increase your ability to...
irritate fans of the show?
to play Settlers of Catan while you're playing this game.
I'm not knocking Will Wheaton. I actually like the guy.
I do. He is hilarious. He really puts out some funny stuff.
He's a pretty cool... I was going to say kid, but he's not.
He's not, no. He's a big gamer. He's got his own kids. Combat is simple. It's just a skill check with the attacker's weapon value versus the defender's shield value. Each player can play one command card to influence the combat, but that's it. If the attacker wins, the defender takes damage. Players can attempt to evade combat or break away. There's so many things going on, and they all mesh together into a wonderfully Star Trek-themed board game experience. There are those who will not like the randomness of the fleets and the location tiles. In fact, in one game, I was faced with empty space and black holes surrounding my command post entirely, while my opponent had a habitable planet on the first tile he landed on.
Nice!
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was fun. This is one of those games that leave you with a story. There's a lot that can happen. There's strategies you can try and encounters that you have to face. I loved this game. Even when the fate turned against me, it was still a great time. There's an excellent replayability value with all of the different ships and cards and encounters and locations. The rulebook has many examples. It's easy to read. It isn't laid out very well and could have benefited from a player summary aid. There's sort of one on the back of the rulebook, but you'll be paging through the rulebook so much during the game that you don't really have time to watch the back of it. So I'm already really looking forward to getting a Romulan expansion. I don't know if there's one in the works. I asked. They wouldn't tell me.
None of your damn business, sir.
Which would add the ability to play a three-player game rather than just two or four. Plus, maybe a Borg expansion, which would make an excellent solitaire game.
The Gorn. The Tholians.
The Gorn. I'm going to build a cannon out of gunpowder.
Well, we used to play Starfleet Battles. I played the Gorn all the time.
I know. I mean, they were in like one episode.
I know.
But back then, there weren't 18 yes. flavors of Trek that you could choose from. You know?
Of course not. There was one.
Exactly. There's so many possibilities, and I'm really hoping that WizKids continues this line. It is a really good game. I really liked it a lot.
I knew that you were getting your hands on the game. I thought to myself, okay, it's Elliot. It's Star Trek. Elliot's going to be like a pig in a pigsty, you know?
Yeah, you're right. It is definitely much more fun for Star Trek fans. Because there's so much Trek theme built into it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a point where you could actually end up beaming Tribbles over onto a Klingon ship.
Well, that wouldn't be good.
No, not at all. Because, of course, Tribbles hate Klingon.
Right. And they multiply like...
I had one time where I managed to find a black hole with one of my weaker ships. And this thing just got sucked into this black hole. And that was it. It was toast. I was like, oh, come on. I had three turns to try to get out of it. But I just couldn't pull it off. I couldn't do the dive. Rolls to get it.
Damn.
Shloop. There it is. It's in another universe.
See ya. Now, you mentioned there's 24 miniatures in the game?
Yes, there is. And they're not 12. To scale.
Oh, really?
No, they're not to scale. Some of the ships are way, way smaller than some of the bigger ships. They do have size variations in them.
Mm-hmm.
So the bigger ships are a little bigger and the smaller ships are a little smaller.
So with 24 miniatures, I could guess that you might see some people who play other Star Trek miniatures games possibly going out and picking this up just to score the ships.
Yeah, you're right. They would be perfect for it. Oh, man. I loved the miniatures. I really did.
Good to see that your Star Trek geekiness was satisfied by the game.
Oh, I'm telling you. I can't wait for a Romulans one to come out if they go for it.
Oh, I would think they probably.
Mm-hmm.
They have the Hunger Games stuff coming out. You think they're going to just take a pass on putting out more Star Trek stuff?
The Hunger Games.
In our final review, I'm going to tackle the Mistborn Adventure game from Crafty Games, designed by Patrick Kupira and Alex Flagg, and it was just released at the end of last year, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
It is a role-playing game, so as far as number of players and the time to play, well, come on, it's a role-playing game. I'm going to begin the review with a preface. I've never read any of the Mistborn novels, although I know Elliot has and highly recommends them.
Yes, I have.
And I did begin to listen to the audiobook edition of the first in the series, and I don't know if it was because I wasn't a big fan of the narrator, the time of day I normally listen to nonfiction, which is at night before I go to bed, or that simply I couldn't get into the story.
Tell you the truth. I bet it's probably the narrator, because this is the same guy who narrates all the Wheel of Time books, who I think is fabulous, but you just don't seem to get into it.
I just don't know. But I will mention I'm approaching this review with no real knowledge of the setting. Crafty Games, on the other hand, is a company I'm familiar with, and I really enjoyed their Fantasy Crafts core book and should have some reviews of a couple of their supplements for that system in the future. I was interested in what Patrick Kupira and Alex Flagg were going to bring to the table as far as the Mistborn adventure game. I'm also going to point out the reviews of the digital download for the book as opposed to an actual physical tome itself. Digital download has grown on me more and more since I picked up a really nice tablet last year. Before that, you would not have caught me dead in front of a computer monitor reading a book since I stare at a computer all day long in the real world. I'd still prefer to have a physical book if I were to be running the game because I normally find it easier to jump right to a page with the info I might be looking for rather than scanning through a file. I know Elliot and I both found it interesting that Mistborn series author Brannon Sanderson was intimately associated with Crafty Games during the creation of the role-playing game, not only writing some short fiction for the introduction, but also adding comments throughout the text and playtesting the system as well. You normally don't run across that kind of involvement when you encounter licensed material. Let's start off by saying this is one big book. 500 pages, my friends, so if you think you're simply buying one of those rather short RPGs based on a licensed property, you're going to be sorely mistaken. I'll also mention that this is an entirely new role-playing system and is not based on the previously mentioned Fantasy Craft and runs a bit lighter rules-wise than that 3.5 Open Gaming license series. The book opens with a short story called The 11th Medal by Sanderson himself. I'd say it's a pretty good read overall. Unlike many short stories that tend to open the proceedings in many role-playing games, The story also serves as the player's introduction to what sets this fantasy setting apart from others in the genre, allomancy. Allomancy is a sort of magic that deals with metals of all sorts, and knowing how to weave these metals can unlock great powers and effects. The Mistborn setting is one of an Industrial Revolution-era land in which a fascist government rules the people, and the populace have very few options outside of conformity or death. This may sound a bit like steampunk, and I suppose in some ways it is, but true steampunk is historically based, at least to some degree, whereas the land of Scadrial is a completely fictional locale. As I've mentioned, most of the inhabitants of Scadrial aren't enjoying their lot in life, but there are a few people who are willing to buck the system, whether by skirting the law as bandits and thieves, or looking to obtain a higher goal and free the people from oppression. This is where the players come in. Player characters comprise what is called a crew, and that's a group of individuals from various backgrounds who are looking to achieve a common goal, regardless if it's getting rich quick, rising to power themselves, or perhaps even vying for loftier goals. There's plenty of wiggle room in the sorts of characters and adventures that can take place in the Mistborn setting. Character creation is especially well presented, and if a bit long-winded in parts, as are quite a few sections in this book, they leave very little room for error. I find it particularly interesting there's a lot of balance involved with the characters players will game with around the table. For many players, and I suppose those intimately familiar with the setting, I guess the obvious choice of character type would be the Mistborn, those who can ingest metal and turn around and use those metals for magical results. Yet, regardless of character type, focusing on one particular area, in this case magic, leaves your character weak in other areas. Characters are broken down into powers, attributes, and standings, and one must assign a rating of weak, average, or strong to each, with no two ever being the same. So if you're strong in powers, something else is average, and the other is weak. The character creation is based more upon a question and answer session as opposed to just skill point allocation, so this can be a time-consuming process. Mistborn isn't the sort of game where a player will create a character at home and bring it along to the game. as a whole, it's the crew that's going to make an impact on the game world. And you'll want to have your core group of gamers together during the character creation process so you know what the goal of that group is and who will be the best individuals who can lead to successfully meeting whatever their goal may be. The rules in themselves are fairly simple, as the mechanics and concept work pretty well together. This isn't to say the main mechanic for action resolution won't leave a few people scratching their heads if they played other role-playing games. The system uses a D6-based dice pool mechanic that allows for traits and modifiers to the die results. Depending on what you're rolling to do, fighting, convincing someone to see things your way, sneak past the guard, etc., will determine the number of dice you roll, as well as the difficulty number you'll need to succeed. The GM, or in this system, the narrator, will tell you what number you need to roll or higher, and you want to roll doubles of that number or higher, and if you have more than one set of doubles, you choose which ones you use. Sixes are good if you succeed, and bad if you don't. But a big boost to everything you do within this system is the ability to describe in detail just what you're looking to achieve. Some players will make this resolution system a little more complex than it needs to be, but once you get the hang of it, the trickiness of the mechanic does seem to fade. I'll say I'm not a big fan of some of the ways in which the numbers are manipulated, but I'll get to that in a bit. The second section of the book discusses each and every one of the forms of magic in great detail, covering history, methods, and mechanics. Each type of magic is unique and has a lot of flavor, and it's going to lead to a multitude of character types that can be gamed. There's a lot of information here to process, and it's laid out sensibly and very well structured. In many role-playing game systems I've found throughout the years, the magic rules and the structure of them tend to be the worst laid out or explained, and happily this isn't the case here. The final portion of the book is for narrators and goes into detail about not only running the game, but also tackling what makes the Mistborn setting much different than any other. Granted, there are plenty of spoilers for those who haven't read the trilogy or the offshoot novel, but items like creating the secret goings-on behind the scenes, putting together stories in which the characters are really larger than life and making an impact on the game world, as well as tying threads together to make a full narrative, are discussed in detail. This section is where I think Crafty Games really shines, as I was a big fan of this sort of material in Fantasy Craft. At 500 plus pages, the Mistborn adventure game is by no means a simple game, but even at that length, I don't find too much of the system to be overwrought or difficult to digest. In some ways, I find the mechanics to be new just for the sake of being new and wanting to create a completely different core system that is truly Crafty's product, and I don't really have a beef with that. I will make mention that I've never been a big fan of some of the artificial means that some systems try to inject in order to promote what they feel is good role-playing, and I think to some extent Crafty Games is doing that here. If I'm the narrator and you as the player can tell me in great detail what you're looking to accomplish in your task, you'll have a much easier time doing so. Unfortunately, some players who enjoy role-playing games can't be that creative on the fly. Hell, I've run across a lot of DMs who aren't that mentally nimble either, and Mistborn as written penalizes those people in some ways. Lastly, I'm not a fan of the new era of thinking that a role-playing game is a great democracy in which the players take adventures off into any direction as they please. This isn't meant as a critique pointed at Mistborn specifically, but more toward the genre recently. There is a little bit of that in this rulebook, but I have to point out I'm old school. Rather than just showing up and running something completely off the top of my head, as many dungeon masters and game masters currently do, I always came to the table with a clear idea and a game plan in mind of what I was looking to achieve on any given evening. In the past couple of years, I've sat in on any number of role-playing game sessions, and regardless of what system was being gamed, I've walked away utterly unimpressed with the crop of game mastering that's currently out there. I'm not picking on people new to the hobby either, because even in the 1980s, there were plenty of people I didn't think were very good refs either. Thankfully, even though I have some minor quibbles with the Mistborn game design, the gang at Crafty take plenty of time to help shine a light on good game mastering that can be used by anyone, regardless if you're running a Mistborn setting or not. Overall, the Mistborn adventure game is an exceptionally fine outing, and Crafty Games has proven that they can put together their own rule system based on an outside intellectual property, nonetheless, that will have strong appeal to role players looking for something different, and truly is a must-have for fans of Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn world.
Which I have enjoyed quite a bit.
Yes, I know.
I really like how they do the magic, which the way it works is not every person, but some people have the ability to burn metals.
Yes.
Only certain types of metals. Mistborn can burn all the types of metals.
Yes, right.
Right. So they have to have this specially concocted alloy made that they drink. So they have these vials that are made from these alloys that they have these people craft for them. And they drink them and get these metals into their system. And then they burn these out of their system to create the various types of magic. Like moving coins around is from burning iron, or pewter enhances your senses and things like that. I thought it was really an intriguing way to do a magic system. Within the whole Mistborn series. And then, of course, the steampunk thing comes in because it's mostly medieval. They all have swords and there's no guns flying around or anything like that.
But it is in the midst of somewhat of an industrial revolution going on.
Yeah, and they have these things called the Inquisitors, who have spikes going through their eyes, out the back of their heads, and they have all these accoutrements that they wear that would look very steampunkish, I believe. Who are the super bad guys within it?
No one expects the Spanish Inquisition.
I haven't tried the RPG yet, but I highly recommend the books.
I like the system. I really do. But as I mentioned, there's some things that are that tend to be kind of the norm now that I'm not a huge fan of.
Yeah.
And one of them is, and I see it in a lot of different role-playing games, where it's sort of the referee, keeper, dungeon master, whatever you want to call them, is part of a collective whole. And all the players, they kind of almost vote on what they're doing and what they want to do. And maybe it's because the vast majority of the time I was running a horror-based role-playing game, where if I allowed yourself or anyone else who was playing to take the game off in those kind of directions, there would never have been that kind of payoff as far as the story itself.
Right, exactly. And loved the way that worked.
Let's be honest, if we had allowed, let's say, your nephew Paul that kind of pull in a game, we would have ended up in all sorts of craziness, and it would have just really boiled down to into a waste of time.
Right. Most of us would have either ended up in prison or something similar. And what fun is that?
In the real world, after we strangled him. So yes, Mistborn is an excellent pickup. As I mentioned, it is the digital download that I did a review of. The copy I have, there are some errors floating around. I'm assuming that that will be addressed when the print version arrives, and I'm sure it's very possible they've updated the file itself online. I know you had mentioned to myself that you don't believe the print version's out yet. I don't believe it is either. So I'm sure those issues will be addressed.
Yeah, I'm sure they will.
There you have it.
Yeah, looking forward to that one.
So an interesting read, and I definitely guarantee, since you're a fan of the series, you'll enjoy reading it as well. As long as you've read all the books, then nothing's going to be spoiled for your enjoyment of reading those books.
That's right.
That would be it for our reviews. And before we finish up, I did want to mention something about the Daily Dope.
Ah, the Daily Dope.
And I think this is going to be a little bit of bad news. And it's not, I think I'm going to stop doing it. I think we're going to stop doing the Daily Dope. Not because we can't do it. I mean, we've shown over 2 months that we can pull off a weekday news show.
Yeah, yes, we have.
But I think it's having a negative effect on the website itself. And I don't think that 60 or 70 downloads of the show on a daily basis is worth the effect it's having on the rest of the website. From the fact that when we do the news, we don't post the news when we post the Daily Dope, because we want people to listen to the Daily Dope, not necessarily go to the website to get the news. But we don't want people who don't listen to the news missing out on the news
right
on the website. And there's only so much time time of the day that can be devoted to the operations of the gaming gang. And I think by us doing the Daily Dope, we're not getting the interviews and things like that that we should be putting together and sharing as extras because we just don't have the time.
It's true. Oh, I've got a finite amount of time that I can dedicate to this stuff. And putting together just the one show a week for me took a lot of time, mm-hmm. which took away from time doing other things on the website.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I'm right with you. So at this point in time, and we do have other contributors, but they really don't contribute much. And that's something that I'm sure our regular visitors and that know already. If we had more people who were actually providing us with more content that we could get out there, by all means, we would continue to do the weekday show. But at this point in time, it's best for the website itself and to be able to bring people things that are exclusive to the gaming gang, such as doing interviews with different people out there in the industry, as opposed to focusing on putting together a 10 or 15 minute show every day. I think the Daily Dope loses out in the end.
Yeah, well, I'm right there with you, bud.
Okay, just wanted to let everybody know that. I think we gave it a pretty damn good run, but as far as what we're doing and our game plan for the website, I think we're better served just sticking to the things that we do on the website and our bi-weekly podcast.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, I'm sure you're happy to hear that because you're like, oh man, now I don't have to do that one show a week. Oh, thank goodness.
Right. Well, you're doing four. Yeah, I know it's much more. But for me, it was still, I mean, no, it'll take me 6 hours to do that, you know?
Oh my gosh, didn't take me that long. But still, I'm sure that we could be better served and our listeners and visitors would be better served by other avenues for our energies.
Yep, I agree.
Very cool. So that's the show for this time around. Elliot, anything else you'd care to add?
Think green. St. Paddy's Day is coming up.
There you go. I thought maybe you were being environmentally conscious.
See, it's cool. It's like a meshing of the two. That's what I was going for.
Think renewable green. All right, my friend, why don't you take us out?
All right.
You've been listening to the Gaming Gang Podcast with Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller. If you'd like to know more about the topics or games we discussed in this episode, please visit our website at www.thegaminggang.com. If you would like to have your opinion heard or have a gaming issue you'd like us to discuss on a future podcast, you can visit the Gaming Gang Guild on BoardGameGeek or call us at 480-779-7365 and leave a message. If you enjoyed listening to our podcast, please rate us on iTunes. Some of the games discussed on our show were provided to the Gaming Gang in the form of review copies. On behalf of everyone here at the Gaming Gang, thanks for listening.